The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling, well, maybe the ultimate historical cold case. The Trojan War.
The foundational story, right?
Absolutely. The story that, you know, launched 1,000 ships, maybe shaped Western civilization itself. But the big question, the one that's bugged scholars forever, is did it actually happen? So we're diving into Eric H. Klein's fantastic synthesis, The Trojan War, a very short introduction.
And it's such a core dilemma, isn't it? Is the Iliad real history or just one of the greatest adventure stories ever told?
Exactly.
What Klein does so well, I think, is he moves us past that simple, kind of reductive yes or no.
Yeah, he refuses that.
Okay.
So our mission today is really to get a quick, but, you know, a thorough and nuanced look at the actual historical evidence, what's out there that might support the legend.
And to appreciate the detective work.
Oh, definitely. The incredible, messy, interdisciplinary detective work involved in trying to bridge that huge gap between Homer's myth and, well, the reality of the late Bronze Age.
And you need the right guide for that kind of work. Someone fluent in multiple languages. And I don't just mean Greek.
Right.
You need the language of archaeology, pottery shards, ruined walls, and the really complex language of ancient diplomatic texts. Because, you know, figuring out if this myth has historical roots, that changes how we see the whole formation of Greek identity.
Speaking of guides, that brings us neatly to Eric H. Klein.
Yes. Klein is, well, he's a serious academic heavyweight. He's an American archaeologist, historian, professor of classics and anthropology at George Washington University.
And he's just perfectly positioned for this, isn't he?
Absolutely. His expertise is right there in that interconnected world of the late Bronze Age Aegean and the ancient Near East.
What makes him stand out, I think, is that he's genuinely fluent in these three academic worlds that, let's be honest, often don't talk to each other much.
That's so true.
He can dissect Homeric poetry with the classicists, sure. But he can also sift through pottery shards with the archaeologists. And this is the key bit, decipher those tiny, complex cuneiform tablets with the Hittitologists.
And his earlier book, 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed, that really cemented his authority.
Mm-hmm. Big impact.
Yeah. He doesn't just look at the Greeks in isolation. He gets the whole chessboard, you know, the trade, the diplomacy, the eventual collapse that defined that whole era, the 13th, 12th centuries BCE.
And that multidisciplinary approach is just vital. It stops him from, you know, finding some big walls and shouting, aha, Homer was right.
Right. No single smoking gun thinking.
He needs corroboration. He needs the poetry, the pottery, and the political records all kind of pointing in the same general direction.
Okay, so let's unpack Klein's main argument in the book then.
Right. He starts by saying, look, the Trojan War, as we usually picture it, 10-year siege, gods intervening, giant wooden horse, that's definitely a myth. That's the literary story.
But, and this is the crucial part, the nuance, that story isn't built on nothing. It's built around a complex historical reality, which scholars often call a historical kernel.
A kernel of truth.
Exactly. A memory of real conflict, maybe multiple conflicts, that got refined, simplified, and, you know, amped up over centuries into this amazing epic poem.
So the whole investigation, the way Klein lays it out, rests on this careful triangulation of evidence. He calls it the three-legged stool approach.
I like that metaphor. Okay, so leg number one, the literary tradition, Homer's epics. What story did the Greeks actually tell themselves?
Leg two, the archaeological record. What can the dirt, the ruins, the stuff they dig up at the site, Hisarlik or Troy, actually tell us?
And leg three, the one that really stabilized things in modern times, is the contemporary textual evidence, specifically those archives from the Hittite Empire, Troy's powerful neighbors to the east.
Right.
And when you look at the outcome the synthesis Klein presents, it's pretty powerful. None of these sources alone proves the Iliad is literal history. Of course not. But when you put them together, they converge. They point towards real, sustained political friction, maybe military conflict, between Mycenaean Greeks and a major city over in Anatolia.
And crucially, happening right around 1200 BCE, the right time frame.
Exactly.
Okay, let's dig into that first leg then. The literary evidence. Homer. Why is the Iliad such a tricky source to use for history?
Well, the biggest problem is time. Homer, or whoever Homer was composing this stuff around the 8th century BCE.
Which is, what, 400 or 500 years after the supposed events?
A huge gap. Staggering, really. And it wasn't written down immediately. It was passed down through what scholars call oral formulaic poetry.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
Think of it less like a fixed book and more like a living performance piece. Each generation of singers or bards, they adapt it, reshape it slightly for their audience. They use stock phrases, repeated lines, things that were easy to remember and perform.
So changes are inevitable.
Absolutely. That kind of transmission guarantees distortion over centuries. It's like that game of telephone, but lasting 500 years.
Yeah. Okay. So what's amazing then is that anything historically accurate survived.
Right. And some things did seem to survive. You get this weird mix. There are genuine Bronze Age echoes stuck in there alongside obvious mistakes or anachronisms from Homer's own time.
Like what kind of mistakes?
Well, he mentions characters using iron tools, for example. Iron wasn't common until after the Bronze Age collapse, or certain burial practices that belonged to the 8th century, not the 13th.
It's like watching a movie about World War II where someone pulls out a smartphone.
Exactly, it breaks the illusion. But then you have something like the famous catalog of ships in the Iliad.
Ah, yes, the long list.
That incredibly detailed list of Bronze Age towns and territories that sent ships. Many of those places had vanished or were totally unimportant by Homer's time, the 8th century.
Why include them?
It suggests the detail must come from a much older source. It implies the epics do preserve some kind of genuine, even if it's distorted, cultural memory of an earlier, more heroic age.
Okay, so the poems are suggestive but flawed. Let's move to leg two, the archaeology, shifting from poetry to pottery.
Yes, and Klein really highlights the huge contrast between the early digs and modern scientific approaches. You start with Heinrich Schliemann.
The ultimate romantic figure, right?
Yeah.
Wealthy businessman, obsessed with Homer, literally takes a shovel to the hill called Hisarlik in Turkey in the 1870s, convinced it's Troy.
He was a visionary, no doubt. Driven. But all the methods. He was basically an amateur and a destructive one, rushing through layers, looking for Priam's treasure.
And destroying crucial evidence in the process.
Sadly, yes. Evidence that later, more careful archaeologists really could have used to piece together the timeline properly. It's a real loss.
Thankfully, things got more scientific later on.
Much more. Klein gives a lot of credit to people like Manfred Korfman and his team, starting in the 1980s. They used modern tech magnetometers, ground-penetrating radar.
Proper science.
Right. And their biggest discovery was just game-changing. They found evidence of a huge, fortified lower city spreading out around the small citadel everyone already knew about.
This was massive, wasn't it? It meant Troy wasn't just some little fort.
Exactly. It was a major regional capital, maybe 10 times larger than people thought. Suddenly, it looks like a place that is strategically important, a prize worth fighting a major war over. It makes the whole idea of a big Greek expedition much more plausible.
But the site is complicated. Layers upon layers. Nine main cities built on top of each other over millennia. So the big archaeological question became, which Troy was Homer's Troy? Which layer matches the story?
And the debate really focused on two main candidates, Troy the Sixth and Troy the Eighth.
Okay, break those down for us. Troy the Sixth, what's the story there?
Troy the Sixth dates from about 1750 down to maybe 1300 BCE. And visually, it fits Homer's descriptions really well. Well-walled Troy, towering Troy. It had these magnificent sloping stone walls, impressive towers, grand buildings inside.
Looks the part.
Definitely looks the part. But the evidence for its destruction, it points overwhelmingly to a massive earthquake around 1300 BCE. Collapsed walls, buckled foundations, not sacks, and burning by enemies.
Okay, so maybe not the Homeric city then. What about Troy the Eighth?
Troy the Idiot was built pretty quickly on the ruins of Troy the Sixth. It dates closer to that critical period, roughly 1300 to maybe 1180 BCE, placing its destruction around 1200 BCE.
The right time frame.
The right time frame. But architecturally, it was less grand, more cramped. People seem to be subdividing the old big houses from Troy the Sixth. And crucially, archaeologists found these huge storage jars, pithoi, sunk into the floors everywhere.
Suggesting what? Siege preparation.
That's the interpretation.
Yeah.
Stockpiling food and water inside the walls, preparing for a long siege. And the clincher, Troy the Eighth was violently destroyed. There was widespread fire damage, skeletons in the streets, arrowheads lodged in the walls. Clear signs of human conflict around 1200 BCE.
So how does Klein synthesize this? It seems like Seed fits the description, but Vitha fits the destruction story and the timing.
His synthesis is really elegant, I think. He suggests that the oral tradition over those centuries likely conflated the two.
Ah, merged the memories.
Exactly. The epic memory probably took the visual grandeur and the impressive walls of the earlier mighty Troy the Sixth and combined it with the violent human-caused end of the later, much less grand, but definitely besieged Troy the Eighth. You get the best walls with the worst ending.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, now for that crucial third leg of the stool, the textual evidence, the game changer.
Absolutely the game changer. For centuries, the debate was basically Homer versus the archaeology. Two legs, a bit wobbly. The Hittite archives provided that essential third leg. External, objective, contemporary written evidence from the time period.
This is where it gets really compelling, I find. The Hittites were this huge empire in central Anatolia to the east of Troy.
Huge power.
Yeah.
And in their capital, Hattusa, archaeologists found thousands of clay tablets, their state archives, written in cuneiform.
And these tablets talk about?
They talk about politics in western Anatolia. And they mention repeatedly a significant city-state over there called Willusa.
Willusa, okay.
Now, when linguists analyze the name, allowing for how languages change, Willusa is a very, very good match for the Greek name, Deluilios. Ilios is just another name for Ilion, or Troy.
Wow. Okay, so a linguistic link.
A strong linguistic link. But it gets better. These same Hittite documents talk a lot about a powerful kingdom over to the west, across the sea. A kingdom that causes them trouble sometimes. They call this kingdom Ahiawa.
Ahiawa. Sounds a bit like...
Achaeans. Homer's word for the Greeks. The scholarly consensus now is overwhelming. Ahiawa almost certainly refers to the Mycenaean Greeks.
So the Hittites are writing diplomatic letters about tensions involving a city called Willusa, sounds like Troy, and a people called Ahiawa, sounds like the Greeks.
Precisely. And these aren't myths or legends. These are state treaties, letters between kings, diplomatic complaints. Real-world politics, ruling points to specific documents like the Alexandru Treaty, a treaty between the Hittite king and a ruler of Volusia named Alexandru, which sounds remarkably like Alexandros.
Paris. Helen's abductor. His other name was Alexander.
This is very suggestive, isn't it? And then there's the Tolgala letter, which details real friction, military posturing, maybe even skirmishes, between the Hittites and the Ahiawa about Volusia. Right in the 13th century BCE.
This is the historical kernel right here, isn't it?
It's the historical kernel in its purest, most concrete form we have. Independent, contemporary confirmation. Real political tensions. The right players, a city matching Troy, a people matching the Mycenaeans, the right place, the right time. A real-world clash of powers in the late Bronze Age.
Okay, let's take a step back then. What are the big takeaways? What does this whole interdisciplinary detective story that Klein models so well really teach us?
Well, the first big one for me is just the sheer power of interdisciplinary inquiry. That three-legged stool metaphor, it's perfect.
Yeah, it really works.
Your understanding is only stable, only reliable, when it's backed up by different kinds of evidence coming from different fields. Whether you're looking at ancient history or, you know, trying to figure out a complex problem at work today, relying on just one source, like only reading the Iliad, it leaves you completely unbalanced.
That's a great point. And the idea of the historical kernel itself is so useful for understanding how memory works, right? Cultural memory.
Definitely. The Trojan War probably wasn't one single 10-year event, exactly like Homer said. It was more likely a composite memory.
Of what? Multiple raids.
Yeah, maybe multiple raids, political struggles, diplomatic incidents over decades, maybe even generations. And over 500 years of retelling, it gets condensed, simplified, dramatized into one epic narrative.
It reminds you that stories, even foundational ones, aren't always literal fact.
Exactly. It teaches you that, you know, factual inaccuracy in the details, maybe there was no giant wooden horse, can coexist with a deeper, essential, emotional truth in a culture's memory. There was great conflict there. Important things happen. You see this in family stories, corporate origin stories. They're simplified narratives built around a core of remembered experience.
And thinking about Troy itself, the Hittite texts really recontextualize Troy, don't they? It wasn't just some random place Helen got taken to.
Not at all. Willusa Troy was clearly a significant player. It was strategically vital, probably controlling access to the Dardanelles Strait and the rich trade routes into the Black Sea.
Which gives the Mycenaeans, the Ahiawa, a much more believable motive than just rescuing Helen.
Absolutely. Rational, economic, geopolitical motives for wanting influence or control over Willusa. That makes so much more historical sense.
And finally, just watching the evolution of the investigation itself is fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Contrasting Schliemann's romantic, Homer-driven digging with Korfman's modern, systematic, multidisciplinary science, it shows how knowledge actually progresses. We get better tools, better questions, more collaboration.
Okay, Klein's writing is also really concise and memorable. There are some great lines that really capture the essence of his approach.
He has a real knack for summing things up.
Like this one, paraphrasing slightly. The question is not whether the Trojan War happened, but what happened.
That's key. It immediately shifts the focus, doesn't it? Away from a simple yes-no, towards the process of investigation. What kind of conflict? Who was involved? Why?
And another one. The Bronze Age world was smaller and more interconnected than we might expect.
Yes. That's crucial context from the Hittite texts and archaeology. We tend to think of ancient history as isolated pockets, but this was an era of intense international trade, diplomacy, royal marriages. Globalization isn't new.
It really isn't. And this one connects to the limits of evidence. Archaeology can tell us what happened, but not why it happened.
That's such an important distinction. The dig can show you a destruction layer, burnt walls, arrowheads. That's the what. But why was it destroyed? Was it Mycenaeans, sea peoples, internal revolt? For the why, you need the historical context, the textual evidence, the interpretation. Archaeology alone isn't enough.
Those lines really encapsulate that modern, nuanced, scholarly approach he champions. So, thinking about real-life applications for you, listening,
yeah,
what can we take away from this?
Well, the most obvious one is critical thinking and source analysis. Klein's whole book is an exercise in it.
How so?
It forces you to constantly ask, what kind of source am I looking at? Homer's Iliad aimed to entertain, to inspire, to memorialize heroes. It did not aim to be a factual historical record in our modern sense.
So apply that today.
Apply it to everything. When you read a news article, watch an ad, see a social media post, read a company report, ask, what is the source's primary goal here? Is it to inform objectively, or is it to persuade, to sell, to entertain, to spin? Understanding the purpose of the source is step one.
That's really valuable. What else?
Understanding the difference between truth and memory. We learned that factual inaccuracy in details, like the wooden horse maybe, can coexist with a deeper emotional or essential truth in cultural memory.
So recognizing that stories we tell ourselves, whether personal or collective, are often simplified narratives.
Exactly. They capture a feeling, a significance, even if the literal facts get fuzzy over time. Think of family legends or, again, those corporate origin stories. They serve a purpose beyond just strict accuracy.
And my final takeaway application builds on what you said earlier, separating evidence from interpretation. Khan is so careful about this.
Mm-hmm.
He'll say, here's the raw data, an ash layer, a Hittite name, a pot style. And then he'll say, here's the story, the interpretation we can weave from this data, acknowledging the inferences.
Which encourages a healthy skepticism in us.
Right. Don't just accept the narrative. Ask, what's the actual evidence behind this interpretation? Where are the leaps?
That's critical thinking in action.
Okay, final thoughts. What surprised you most, or what was your biggest takeaway from revisiting Khan's work?
For me, honestly, it remains the incredible detail and the sheer reality brought by the Hittite texts.
Yeah, me too.
Just knowing that real kings and diplomats centuries ago were writing actual letters about the political tensions surrounding Wallusa and the Ahiawa, it just grounds the whole thing. It provides that essential geopolitical motive that makes the conflict understandable in human terms, beyond just mythic heroes and abducted queens. It turns it into real politics.
It really does. It makes it feel so much more plausible somehow.
And my final thought would be this. Klein doesn't diminish the myth by grounding it. I think he actually enriches it.
How do you mean?
By showing the complex historical soil from which this incredible story likely grew, he adds depth and resonance. The book is a masterclass in intellectual humility, too. It shows that sometimes embracing ambiguity, acknowledging what we don't know, and integrating multiple messy perspectives, that often leads to the most satisfying and, frankly, the most sophisticated understanding of the past. It's just fantastic historical detective work.
A perfect summary. It really is a journey. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.